Today is Monday, April 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The daughter of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny calls on authorities to ensure her imprisoned father gets immediate medical treatment.
She joins a chorus of international public figures and Russian opposition regional lawmakers who are calling on Vladimir Putin to make sure the Kremlin critic is properly treated.
Plus, the Czech Republic and Russia expel diplomats after Prague blames Moscow for 2014 blast. We'll have these stories and more next. Allies of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny have unveiled plans for what they hope will be the largest protest in modern Russian history on Wednesday. This as Washington warned Russia it would pay a price if he dies in jail from his hunger strike. The protest date was brought forward after a medical trade union with ties to Navalny said on Saturday he was in a critical condition. It cited medical tests, which it said showed that Navalny's kidneys could fail soon, which could lead to cardiac arrest. Reuters' Maha Albadrawi is up first.
Alexei Navalny's daughter, Dasha, has pleaded with Russian authorities to allow a doctor to treat her father, who is on hunger strike in prison after a group of medical professionals warned that he is in critical condition and at risk of kidney failure. The Stanford University student tweeted on Sunday, "Allow a doctor to see my dad." She joins a chorus of international public figures and Russian opposition regional lawmakers who are calling on Vladimir Putin to make sure the Kremlin critic is properly treated. Navalny started refusing food in protest on March 31st after accusing prison authorities of refusing to properly treat acute back and leg pain. Authorities say Navalny was offered medical care but refused it, insisting on being treated by a doctor of his choice from outside the facility. The request was denied. In a television interview with the BBC, Russia's ambassador to Britain accused Navalny of attention-seeking, adding, quote, he will not be allowed to die in prison.
Maha Albadrawi reports for Reuters News. Moscow expelled 20 Czech diplomats on Sunday. Russia's move came in response to Czech allegations that two Russian spies accused of a nerve agent poisoning in Britain in 2018 were behind an earlier explosion at a Czech ammunition depot that killed two people. Prague on Saturday had ordered out 18 Russian diplomats, and in response, Moscow vowed on Sunday to force the authors of this provocation to fully understand their responsibility for destroying the foundation of normal ties between the two countries. Moscow gave the Czech diplomats just a day to leave, while Prague had given the Russians 72 hours. The Czech Republic said that it had informed NATO and European allies that it's suspected Russia of causing the 2014 blast, and European Union foreign ministers are set to discuss the matter at their meeting on Monday. Now, in addition, Russia accused a Ukrainian diplomat on Saturday of trying to obtain classified information and ordered him to leave the country by April 22nd, prompting a similar response from Ukraine as border tensions continued to simmer. Tensions between Moscow and Kyiv have been rising amid a buildup of Russian troops along the border and clashes in eastern Ukraine between the army and pro-Russian separatists. Pope Francis, delivering his Sunday address to a live audience for the first time in more than a month, called for a lowering of tensions in eastern Ukraine and expressed anxiety over the military buildup. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder now brings us this story about an upcoming scheduled election in Syria.
Syria will hold a presidential election on May 26th that is virtually certain to return President Bashar al-Assad for a third term, an event that Washington and the opposition say is a farce designed to cement his autocratic rule. Assad's family and Ba'ath Party have ruled Syria for five decades, with the help of the security forces and the army, where his Alawite minority dominates. This year is the 10th anniversary of a bloody crackdown on pro-democracy protesters, which triggered a civil war that has left much of Syria in ruins. The conflict has sucked in world powers, killed hundreds of thousands of people, and displaced millions. But it's now nearing its end, with Assad, supported by Russian and Iranian allies, back in control of most of the country. Candidates for May's election must have lived in Syria for the last 10 years, which prevents key opposition figures in exile from standing. Assad came to power in 2000 after the death of his father, longtime President Hafez al-Assad. His supporters say Washington and its Western allies are seeking to bring Assad down with the crippling sanctions they have imposed.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder. The United Nations Refugee Agency is calling for greater security for civilians caught in a raging battle between Yemeni government forces and Houthi rebels for control of the northern governorate of Marib. Lisa Schlein has the details.
Marib is the last major city still held by the Saudi-backed government in northern Yemen, which is largely under the control of Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. The city's internally displaced persons camps are sheltering one quarter of Yemen's 4 million internally displaced people. Aid agencies believe they are in great danger. In the first 3 months of this year, the UN Refugee Agency reports at least 70 incidents of armed violence have resulted in many deaths and injuries. UNHCR spokeswoman Ekaterini Kitidi says there were 40 civilian casualties in March alone, the highest number in 1 month since 2018.
Airstrikes, shelling and crossfire have also badly damaged civilian infrastructure and property, including informal sites hosting the displaced, water tanks and shelters. Livestock has also been killed, depriving already impoverished communities of their livelihoods.
The UNHCR is renewing its call on all warring parties to take measures to protect civilians and civilian infrastructure. That includes sites hosting the displaced, which it says should not be turned into possible military targets. Since the escalation of fighting, more than 13,600 residents in the region have been forced to flee their homes. Katidi says the new displacement is putting a heavy strain on public services. As a consequence, she says families are forced to share their shelters with up to three other families.
1 in 4 families have no access to toilets, showers, or hand washing facilities near their shelters. With the second wave of COVID-19 hitting Yemen and only half of the country's health facilities functioning, the lack of sanitary services is making the situation more dire.
A recent UNHCR protection assessment finds women and children represent almost 80% of the displaced population in Marib. It reports about a quarter of the children do not go to school. Most displaced families live on less than $1.40 a day. The United Nations calls Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN reports nearly 250,000 people have died since the civil war began more than 6 years ago. It notes nearly two-thirds of Yemen's 24 million people need international assistance to survive. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Clashes between a recently banned Islamist party and police in Pakistan's second largest city of Lahore reportedly left at least 2 people dead and scores of others wounded on Sunday. The Tehrik-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or TLP, was demanding that Pakistan expel the French ambassador over the remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron, who has defended freedom of expression regarding caricatures of Islam's prophet Muhammad. Police from Punjab province said Sunday's action was in response to the TLP attacking a police station, trapping officers and rangers, members of a paramilitary force inside, kidnapping a senior police officer, and stealing an oil tanker containing 50,000 liters of fuel. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Libby Hogan from Reuters News reports that security forces in Myanmar opened fire on protesters Saturday.
Security forces opened fire on demonstrators in Myanmar's northern city of Mogok on Saturday. They had gathered to show support for the formation of a national unity government on Friday, which includes leaders of the anti-coup protests, ethnic minorities, and detained leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Video obtained by Reuters showed a man injured on the ground, attempting to drag himself to safety before being carted away in a trolley by security forces. At least 2 people were killed by security forces in Mogok, the city known for its ruby mining. Myanmar has been in upheaval since the military led by junta chief Min Aung Hlaing ousted the elected government. Security forces have killed over 700 people, according to an activist group tally. As part of Myanmar's New Year holiday, over 23,000 prisoners were released from jail over the weekend. But few, if any, democracy activists arrested since the coup were thought to be among them. Across the country, crowds gathered on the streets of several towns to show support to the National Unity Government. They have called on the international community not to recognise the junta. The military has shown little willingness to engage with neighbouring countries and no sign of wanting to talk with the government it ousted.
Reuters' Libby Hogan. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says half of all adults in the United States have now received at least one COVID-19 shot and gave new information on the paused Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, tells ABC's This Week,
I believe we'll get back with it, and it might be some restrictions. Not sure what that will be, whether there'll be age or sex, or whether they'll just come back with a warning of some sort.
J&J shots were put on hold due to rare but serious issues with blood clots.
The pause was to take a look, make sure we know all the information we can have within that time frame, and also warn some of the physicians out there who might see people, particularly women, who have this particular adverse event, that they treat them properly.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says that the country is in no rush to reopen its international borders. The borders have been closed to all non-citizens and non-residents since March of last year. Australian citizens and permanent residents can't leave the country due to coronavirus restrictions unless they have an exemption, and returning Australians from overseas also have to quarantine in hotels at their own expense for 2 weeks. Last week, Morrison said they were considering a staggered reopening of its international borders to allow residents who were fully vaccinated against COVID-19 to travel abroad first. Australia is one of the world's most successful countries to have handled the pandemic, with coronavirus cases of around 29,000 in total. But its nationwide vaccine rollout has been a hot political topic, a source of tension between the states and the federal government. But despite its sprawling geography and its often inhospitable climate, Alaska ranks among the top U.S. states for getting COVID-19 vaccines into the arms of its residents, and its indigenous population has played a major role in that achievement. This report is produced by Reuters' Zachary Goldman.
These vials of COVID-19 vaccines are being packed up in a facility in Fairbanks, Alaska. As far as they've come, they've got further to go. These doses are set for the small town of Eagle, a one-time gold rush outpost on the Yukon River near the Canadian border. Despite its remote geography and often inhospitable climate, Alaska ranks among the top U.S. states for getting COVID-19 vaccines into the arms of its residents. By early April, more than 42% of those aged 16 and older had received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, one of the highest rates of inoculation per capita. A large part of that success story is due to efforts by the native population, who use their federally recognized sovereign powers to obtain doses from the U.S. Indian Health Service. Karma Ulvi is the first chief of Eagle Village and a community health aide.
Eagle has roughly about 120 people or so, and we've been able to get about 85 vaccinated, so pretty much the entire community has been vaccinated, and that is really nice for all of us, just since we're so remote out here.
The need is particularly important here. With limited phone and internet service and no wintertime road access, the nearest hospital is at least 3 hours away by aircraft.
You know, we're getting like 60% of our food from subsistence, hunting, fishing, gardening.
Sonia Sager is an Eagle resident who says that even a community that prides itself on self-sufficiency is grateful for the help.
That is in itself very valuable. It's valuable to us, but it's also just valuable to society to have people that can take care of themselves, but we cannot give ourselves the shot. So we are very, very grateful.
Alaska natives imposed some of the nation's earliest and most robust lockdowns and mask mandates to curb the pandemic, but the virus reached the rural sites nonetheless, with devastating results. According to the state epidemiology office, indigenous people accounted for 37% of Alaska's COVID-19 deaths last year, more than twice their proportion of the population. State data show in some extremely remote native villages, vaccination rates are now approaching 90%.
Zachary Goldman reports for Reuters News. A New York social worker and psychotherapist says more is needed to address the pandemic's impact on mental health, particularly among healthcare workers. We have more from VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo.
Amina Woods is a New York social worker and psychotherapist who spent the last year helping clients manage the mental health impact of the coronavirus.
People are not well during this time. People are exhausted. People are feeling overworked. People are overworked.
That includes clients in the medical field who care for COVID patients.
There was a lot of appreciation for the healthcare workers and the work that they do, but I don't think that there's been enough concern about how the work that they've been doing has been impacting their physical health, their mental health.
Officials say it's a global problem. World Health Organization's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
The pandemic has taken a huge toll on their physical and mental health with devastating effects on their families and communities. Anxiety, depression, insomnia, the stress have all increased. I give thanks to those that have stood up in one of humanity's toughest periods.
Woods says she too is among those feeling the mental health toll.
I've had moments where I feel just disorganized, unfocused, anxiety, just living with anxiety like in the pit of my stomach.
The single mother says she's also seen an impact on her 12-year-old son, who, like many kids, has attended school virtually for over a year.
It's definitely taken a toll on his social-emotional health. I've never seen him, and pardon me if I start crying, but I've never seen him so down and so sad.
According to a recent study by the American Psychological Association, prolonged exposure to COVID-19 stressors is taking a toll. Nearly 3 in 10 essential workers in the study reported a decline in their mental health since the start of the pandemic. Woods says she has found ways to cope.
I feel like the deep breath thing might sound cliche almost, like just take a deep breath, but deep breaths really, really help. Sometimes if I'm really, really at the edge, I'll just go in the bathroom and I'll just cry it out, which is helpful. In this little bitty apartment, I started just cruising around, or if I take my garbage out to the incinerator, I'd ride my roller skates to the garbage chute.
Simple steps as people around the world try to push beyond a dark and trying year. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
As U.S. climate envoy John Kerry appeared in Seoul over the weekend to discuss global warming, South Korea's foreign ministry says that it raised concerns to him over Japan's plans to dump contaminated water from its defunct Fukushima nuclear power plant into the sea. Kerry reaffirmed Washington's confidence in that plan.
And the United States is confident that the government of Japan has had very full consultations with the IEA, that the IEA has set up a very rigorous process. I know that, Japan has weighed all the options and the effects, and they've been very transparent about the decision and the process.
Seoul has strongly rebuked the decision.
This is Science in a Minute.
Nearly a decade ago, scientists in the field of physics were excited by news of the discovery of the subatomic particle called the Higgs boson. Physicists are thrilled again after the U.S. Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory released the first results of their Muon G-2 experiment. The Fermi team found that fundamental particles called muons were not acting in a way that was predicted in the standard model, the current best theory of particle physics. From a Fermi Lab press release, the new measurements provide strong evidence that the muon's standard model deviation might open up the possibility of exciting new physics and the existence of new particles and forces. Research that could confirm or contradict these initial findings will continue. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Closing arguments are expected on Monday in the trial of former Minneapolis, Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin after 3 weeks of witnesses from both sides. Jurors have heard from medical experts and other police officers as Chauvin faces murder and manslaughter charges for kneeling on George Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes. Issa Shirai has more.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin invoked his Fifth Amendment right to not testify in his own murder trial Thursday.
Is this your decision not to testify?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. Do you have any questions about your right to remain silent or to testify on your own behalf?
Not at this time, I don't.
All right. Has anyone promised anything or threatened you in any way to keep you from testifying?
No promises or threats, Your Honor.
Do you feel that your decision not to testify is a voluntary one on your behalf?
Yes, it is.
No, the defense rested their case Thursday.
Your Honor, at this time, the defense rests.
Thank you.
Over the past week, the defense has argued that Chauvin's actions against George Floyd were justified, with one former police officer countering what the prosecution's witnesses had said last week.
I felt that Officer Chauvin's interactions with Mr. Floyd were following his training, following current practices in policing, and were objectively reasonable.
The defense also argued that a number of causes may have contributed to Floyd's death, including his prior health, drug use, and possible carbon monoxide poisoning from the exhaust of the squad car.
When you put all of those together, it's very difficult to say which of those is the most accurate. So I would fall back to undetermined.
But the prosecution pushed back on the argument about carbon monoxide, calling on a rebuttal witness.
As to the statement that his carboxyhemoglobin could have increased by 10 to 18%, in your view, that's not possible.
It's simply wrong.
The prosecution and defense in Chauvin's case are expected to make closing statements on Monday before members of the jury begin deliberations. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities in the U.S. state of Wisconsin said on Sunday that they have apprehended a person in connection with a shooting at a busy tavern that left 3 men dead and 3 others injured. The shooting happened earlier on Sunday at the Summers House Tavern in Kenosha County. The suspect had been asked to leave the bar but returned and opened fire. Police said the shots were fired inside and outside the bar, which they described as very busy at the time. Authorities said the suspect is facing a charge of first-degree intentional homicide with additional criminal charges likely after further investigation. A manhunt is also underway for a former sheriff's deputy wanted in a fatal shooting of 3 people in Austin, Texas. Officials said it isn't known if the suspect was still in the city. Interim Austin Police Chief Joseph Chacon said the victims were all known to the suspect. Scientists studying sea turtles say that the ancient animal's numbers are dropping. They mostly blame human activity, but say they hope a new action plan could help the species mount a comeback. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has that story.
Researchers with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, catch a leatherback sea turtle off the coast of California.
Pull!
The tens of millions of years old species is in serious decline, says ecologist Scott Benson.
Estimates are that the population now is about 1,400 adult females remaining. That's down from literally tens of thousands a few decades ago.
Benson co-authored a new study that says the foraging area used by the leatherback sea turtle saw a population drop of about 80% in the past 30 years. He says this is amazing given the species' adaptability.
The leatherback turtle is an ancient mariner. They've been around for almost as long as 80 million years in their present form. Date back to the time of the dinosaurs. It's not a poorly adapted species. They've been through all kinds of things, meteor strikes, climate changes, you name it.
He says the smaller numbers make the species more vulnerable to outside factors like international fishing and egg harvesting. Benson's team puts transmitters on turtles so their fishing fleet can avoid them. He says his team is doing what it can to boost the rapidly dwindling numbers.
We're down to the remnants right now, so any little thing now could potentially disrupt it. So we have just a very little time to turn it around.
All seven species of the leatherback are in trouble, but the new study focuses on the Western Pacific variety, which migrates more than 11,000 kilometers from Indonesia and the Solomon Islands to the U.S. West Coast to feast on jellyfish. NOAA recently released a new action plan calling for greater international cooperation. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And finally, VOA's Heather Maxwell, the host of Music Time in Africa, brings us fresh new music from Nairobi's red hot musical power couple.
5, 6, 7, 8. Let's talk Kenyan pop music. One of the top trending musical acts right now in Kenya is Nameless and Wife Wahoo. David Mathenge, a.k.a. Nameless, and Rosemary Wahoo Kagwi are appearing everywhere right now on social media, TV, radio. Award-winning artists, so no strangers to the Kenyan music industry and the East African music industry. Plus, she's a TV actress. Their 15-plus year marriage and two beautiful daughters all add up to a rooted, admired, well-respected musical power couple.
Am I the victim or am I the villain? I don't even know how all this began.
But since February, their popularity is in overdrive. That's because Nameless and Wahoo started a rollout of releasing beautiful visuals to pre-releases off of their forthcoming album, 12-track album called Mathenge. They also say you can call it MZ or Niz.
Special, baby, something we only see in the movie.
The first video, This Love, was released in February and already has over 1 million YouTube views.
I see you in the dark, light comes.
Wahoo is singing solo while Hubby is playing the main squeeze in the clip. And then on March 31st, the couple released their second one, Te Amo. The song was written by up-and-coming artist Brandon Israel and produced by Sado. Now, this video already has nearly 500,000 YouTube views, and it's the couple's first ever true musical collaboration. It's two brands that are coming together to make this third unique brand, and Kenyans are loving it. They're loving seeing the couple perform together for the first time. And also the way it captures that flirty, fun, light feeling of love and attraction between a man and a woman right in the beginning. And this is also the couple's personal love story. This and all the upcoming tracks to the album, and hopefully all the visuals to every single track, tells the story of their relationship journey. The ups and the downs, the successes and the failures, all those twists and turns. Now, Mathenge's, remember, that's the name of the new brand. They hope to release a single every month or so as a build-up to the release of the full album later on in the year. So get ready for more beautiful, true love stories by this amazing power couple from Kenya, Nameless and Wahoo. Mathenge.
Many thanks to VOA Music Time in Africa's Heather Maxwell for sharing that story with us. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing a web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. be well, be safe, and have a great day.